Welcome to Beyond Leading, the podcast that cuts through the noise to get real about leadership, team dynamics, personal growth, and the messy, brilliant reality of work, life, and everything in between. Each episode brings grounded insights, sharp truths, and honest conversations with experienced leaders and coaches as we explore what it really takes to lead well today. We don't deal in one-size-fits-all answers. We spark ideas, offer grounded perspectives, and create space for you to work out what fits your world. So let's get into it. Every organization says it cares about well-being. There's the fruit bowl, the yoga session, the app on your phone. But if you're a senior leader, you've probably had the suspicion that none of it touches a thing that's actually wearing you down. That gap between the well-being that gets talked about and the well-being you actually live is what this conversation is about. Over the next two episodes, I'm joined by Dr. Calvin Lightbody. Calvin's an NHS consultant in emergency medicine, and he's also a professional coach and a lifestyle medicine practitioner, someone who brings all three together to help leaders and their people stay well under real pressure. He works mostly with senior doctors, healthcare managers, and executives, coaching them one-to-one, in groups, and through workshops and seminars on managing complexity, easing overwhelm, and facing the moral distress and burnout that come with high-stress environments. He also writes The Frayed Bandage, a blog that digs into the real issues across health and social care. And he came into coaching after his own experience of being coached through a difficult year. In this first part, we get honest about what well-being really is, why so many well-meaning initiatives miss the mark, and the warning signs most of us are brilliant at driving straight past. In part two, we go deeper and more personal, what it really costs when high achievers keep pushing, and more importantly, the way back. I've called this two-parter the well-being lie. Calvin, a very warm welcome to Beyond Leading.
Thanks very much, Alec. Thank you very much for the invitation to come and talk to you today.
Oh, an absolute pleasure, and thank you for coming along. Let's start. Opening question. You're an NHS consultant in emergency medicine who became a coach. What do you see in your colleagues and maybe in yourself that made that path feel necessary for you?
Okay, Alec, I think just to be honest, it comes back to myself, really. My coaching experience started back in 2020. It's the pandemic year. It's been pretty miserable for everyone, let's face it. But certainly in Accident Emergency, where I work, it had been a particularly tough experience. I'd had my own health and well-being and career issues that year, and I reached out for some help with coaching. It was just three coaching sessions that I had, but it really, really helped. It just helped me get some clarity about what I was thinking career-wise, and just give me that room to think about what I want to do with my own well-being too. So I actually made quite a few changes on the back of that coaching experience. I don't know if you remember, Alec, we talked about this years ago about how I could use my skills as a clinician to be a good coach. And blending that with that experience of being coached, I pursued getting trained as a coach myself the following year. So, yeah, 5 years ago now, I trained as a coach. I did the advanced certificate of coaching practice through organizational development in the NHS where I work. And I've been coaching ever since. I coach mostly other senior clinicians. I coach some managers, some other allied health professionals, but mostly senior staff in the health service. And yeah, you asked about what I saw in other colleagues. I think really just experiencing the same things that I have. That's usually feeling a bit stuck, feeling a bit of a struggle with what to do next in a career. Maybe it's a choice that's coming up. But what I've also noticed too, Alec, is pretty much everybody has a well-being issue of their own, whether that's something to do with their weights or their diet or their exercise or their sleeping or stress or maybe mental well-being. And that prompted me to do the lifestyle medicine qualification that I took a couple of years ago now. So I took the diploma level qualification in lifestyle medicine through the British Society of Lifestyle Medicine. So I've really helped people by blending in that lifestyle medicine approach with coaching, with my experience as a senior clinician. And that's what I've been really been focusing on, certainly in the last couple of years, blending those three bits of experience, those three bits of learning for the people that I work with.
You mentioned there some of the areas of well-being that you've been working on and some of the issues you see. In the medical world and in the NHS, what do you think is driving that?
Well, I guess there's the short term, there's the long term. I think short term is the demand day to day of patient contact, of targets, of the hospital being full, and that kind of daily pressure that you walk into. Certainly there's a very heavy atmosphere every time I walk into accident emergency. It must be dreadful to be a patient walking in there. But certainly as a staff member, that daily pressure is there. Then there's the long-term stuff too. I mean, that obviously has an impact. That daily considerable stress has an impact. And it impacts on every aspect of your life, really. So it impacts your family, your sleep, how you cope with those stressors. Maybe some people turn to things that are not helpful or positive or a healthy way to deal with stress. So, yeah, I see all of those things right across the board, from junior staff right through to colleagues, through to managers and even executives.
You mentioned there a bit, Calvin, about the short-term impacts in terms of pressure and dealing with patients, and particularly if you think about what's going on in A&E and the stories we hear, and the impact of that longer term. I also see that in the corporate world. We have leaders, that are, some of them will admit they are struggling. That's having an impact on their team. People are generally feeling overloaded in their day-to-day work. What's some of the worst cases you've seen? And to add to that, why?
Yeah, I'm not surprised that there's a similar experience in the corporate world, because I think really it's really every high stakes, high pressure environment, I guess, is going to be feeling a similar consequence to that pressure and that strain, because it's repeated pressure, it's repeated strain. It's not like a peak and trough maybe that we might have had in the past. It's just that constant high level of pressure. So I'm not surprised at all that folk that work in any kind of high stakes, high pressure environment, irrespective of what it is, are going to be relating to that. I can think of my own experiences. I suffered a little bit with my own well-being in 2020. I was quite ill for a few weeks with a viral pneumonia, probably COVID. There wasn't the kind of testing that there was then. And it gave me an opportunity to step back and think, how relevant and valued am I as an employee and as a colleague? Because if I check out here, if I end up leaving out of ill health, or even worse, if I'd succumb to that illness, I realized that, people might have been sad for a little while, but I would have been replaced and folk would have moved on. And it was an important kind of milestone for me to realize that actually I need to take some responsibility for my own well-being here. I need to take some responsibility for my own resilience. So that was a kind of point for me where I made a lot of changes at home, with my career, with the hours that I worked and what I do to address that. Because if you're constantly drained, if you're constantly exhausted, if you're constantly under pressure, it absolutely affects your health. It affects your immune system, affects your sleep, and it leaves you vulnerable to things like infection. So those are the kind of things that I realized that were important for me at that stage of my life and my career. I've seen people, colleagues, who maybe have seen a similar warning light on their dashboard, to use that analogy, but have continued to work at an extremely high and demanding rate, because they probably feel, first of all, that's what's expected of them. But secondly, that they maybe feel that they are, again, like a bit of a superhero. You're an amazing person. You can just get on with it and you can cope with it and you just carry on regardless. And again, just come back to that dashboard analogy. You can keep driving with the warning light on, But there's a risk that you might break down. That's just a reality, I'm afraid. And I have seen that happen. I've seen really strong, resilient people break and become unwell and leave emergency medicine and or maybe be off sick for a protracted period of time with ill health. And that's such a shame because these are really valuable, experienced, superb clinicians that are being lost to the health service, being lost to that place of work, because I feel perhaps they didn't acknowledge the warning lights that were there. So yes, I've seen it myself, I've experienced it myself, but I've also seen it around other really senior clinicians, senior managers as well, that maybe if they could do things again, they would have maybe taken a step back and looked at the bigger picture.
That's interesting you mentioned there. We see it on the dashboard. I love the way you phrased that. But again, it goes back to my question, why do we see it and we typically don't do anything about it? I know I've been guilty of that in the past. What is it you see? What's going on psychologically with us on average that stops us actually saying, I need to stop?
It's the external and it's the internal. So the external stuff would be the pressure, that sustained expectation. Certainly, again, thinking about my own place of work, it's the expectation to see so many patients in so many time and keep a waiting time down. I'm sure in the business world, there'll be other targets to meet, deadlines to meet and so forth. It's that kind of relentless expectation. And that expectation can be unrelentless and just continual. And the internal bit too is that I should be able to cope with this. I should be good at this. And if I'm struggling, then it's what's wrong with me? Why am I not delivering here? So those two things together, I think, are the fuel and the fire that can lead to the problems further down the line. We perhaps have this continual expectation of ourselves too, that you've delivered at such a high level, maybe for many, many years. And then wonder why that's maybe not good enough at the present time. And you maybe struggle with that thought internally. So, yeah, I can see both of those things contributing.
I see a lot in companies who promote well-being initiatives. But from what I'm hearing from you and the experiences you've had, it does get me questioning, are these well-being initiatives serving their purpose, or are they just something that's being advertised, but nothing's actually being done?
Yeah, you're quite right. And I've seen that a lot in the health service. I think we're quite bad for that in the health service. The problem with some of these well-being initiatives is, I guess they mean well. There's a good intention. There's a good intention to do something positive for staff. But what it ends up being is a bit of a token gesture. It's maybe seen as a tick box exercise even, that where the employer, put it that way, is giving something to the employee and being nice about it and being proactive in that way. But and we're very good at sniffing out tokenism. We're very good at recognizing when we're being pandered to, perhaps, in that way in where I work. And it sometimes just leads to a bit of antagonism. It's like, oh, here's another thing we have to do. Here's another bit of pressure, even though the intention might have been to help. I think it comes back to that there's I would describe like a conflict between the employer, if we call them that, thinking that staff just need to be more resilient, need to work hard, and the employee on the other side feeling, this is a terrible place to work. I'm not thriving here. I'm just surviving. I'm just turning up and doing the minimum. This is a terrible place to work. I don't want to be here. We need a better place to work. And you can see the kind of conflict that might arise there between the expectation of the employer and the understanding and expectation of the employee. But what you actually need is both. I think it seems so obvious, but you really need both. You need a really productive, conducive workplace that supports employee well-being at the very basic levels, but you also need employees who take responsibility for their own resilience and take responsibility for their own well-being. And that's where the conflict comes. If you've got a really good workplace that allows people to thrive and you've got resilient people, you get a happy, productive workplace, a thriving workplace. But unfortunately, we're just not seeing that. Even if you've got a really good workplace, but the employees are not motivated and feel that their resilience is poor, you'll get poor productivity. And again, you can see that across the health service. I mean, you don't need to research too hard, too far to see how poorly performing the NHS is just now right across the country. And I think that's a very significant contributing factor. But similarly, you could have people who are quite resilient and are quite robust, but when they're subjected to an extremely stressful, high-pressure workplace that's unrelenting over a long period of time, they will end up burnt out. They will end up burnt out, even if they're resilient to begin with, if they're not in a positive, conducive workplace that addresses the needs that of the very basic things, even like I'm talking about, you know, a place to get changed, you know, a uniform that's comfortable, a tea room where you can have your break, you know, you're guaranteed to get your breaks. You should be able to get away from your place of work at the time that you're supposed to finish. You should have a career plan. You should have a personal development plan. You should have access to a mentor. You should have study time. You should have an opportunity to thrive at your work. You know, those things are all really basic, but if we don't have them, even resilient people can break. I guess the worst case scenario would be where you've got people who aren't terribly resilient and aren't really making an effort to build their own resilience, and a workplace that isn't really involved with making those basic things available, and you end up just with people that are broken or non-productive. The average sickness rate, I think, in the public service is around, public sector is around 4%. In NHS Scotland just now, the sickness rate is 6.4%. So it's more than 50% higher than that average. Now, I do know that some accident emergency departments, I'm not going to say any names because I don't want to get myself in any bother, but it's even higher than that. It's over 8% in some accident emergency departments. So we're seeing the consequences of that, that high sickness rate, poor productivity, poor resilience, poor well-being, because we're not accepting that we need both of those things. And that, for me, is the key underlying issue.
Those are frightening statistics, absolutely frightening. If we think about our leaders in HR and heads of HR that might be listening to this, what is the plan of action? What do we need to start doing now to try and recover this situation and get the team, as you've mentioned there, you know, back to being healthy and happy and productive?
The thing to recognize is that well-being is not a luxury extra. It's not. It needs to be a key core element of any successful, thriving organization. It's absolutely key to see it that way. At the minute, I feel that well-being is seen as a nice extra, as a nice little token extra that you can maybe address at leisure and hand out occasionally. Until that culture changes, where well-being is seen as an essential component of the thriving workforce, then things will not change, I fear. So that's what needs to start, is a change in appreciation and a change in that culture.
This gets me thinking, and going back to your years of experience, if we were recording this 10 years ago, do you think you would have been saying some of the things you've said today? Or do you, as in, you know, this situation, the kind of crisis, I would argue, we're in, was it as bad then? And if not, why not?
I think 10 years ago, we could start to see the problem arising. We could start to see performance deteriorating. We could start to see some of the problems that were in the post back then. With hindsight, you could probably say, well, look, all these trends are pointing in one direction. What are we going to do about that? What are we going to do about staff retention, for example? What are we going to do about deteriorating performance? What are we going to do with recruitment? You know, all those things were starting to trend in a bad direction. The pandemic, I think, was key as well here, Alec. I think the fact that everything shut down for that period of time, I like the analogy of standing on a hose pipe. You know, we stood on a hose pipe and there was just a trickle came out the other side. Emergency departments were actually, you know, relatively quiet apart from sporadic, extremely unwell people. But once you took your foot off, there's this massive gush then, and we've been dealing with that for the last 5 years. The pressure has been extremely high, it's been unrelenting, and performance has been extremely poor. I mean, again, I'm not revealing anything secret here. You can look in any kind of review of healthcare, and it's been terrible for the last 5 years. So I think that's what's happened certainly the last 5 years. I don't think we've really fully appreciated the need for recovery yet, and we're certainly not going the right direction. That figure of 6.4% that I mentioned of staff sickness is the highest it's been in the last 10 years, and again, that trajectory is increasing. So while we continue to see that deterioration, we're not seeing it matched by an investment in the resources that we would need to see that improving.
But do you think part of this, and just going back to the whole well-being question, one of the things I see a lot with my clients is, particularly more in the kind of corporate world, they're online the whole time. And what I mean by that, and we've covered this in previous episodes of Beyond Leading, it's just constant data input. From when they wake up, they're on the mobile phone, then they're checking emails, and then it's listening to podcasts and checking the news, and 16 hours later, 17 hours later, it's time to go to bed. And they've never had any time to stop taking in information. It's what I call, what I say to my clients, have some board time each day, even if it's half an hour. And it's quite interesting, the feedback I get, wow, I felt so much better in the afternoon. I kind of took a 30-minute switch off or board time at lunch, lunchtime, came back in the afternoon, felt was more focused, I had more energy. Mm-hmm. Is that part of, that's what I'm starting to see. But again, coming back to, you said about changing the culture in organizations to kind of adapt to this, but I just feel there's something else, there's another step to that. And is it coming back to our own behaviours? Do we need to maybe sit back and think, what was life like 10, 15, 20 years ago, and actually try and learn some of the habits that we used to do that we seem to have totally forgotten about now?
100%, you're spot on. Humans were never evolved to deal with sitting in a fluorescent light office all day. Yeah, that's just crazy to think that we have evolved to cope with that environment. We don't thrive in that environment. And you'll have seen maybe from some of your clients that there's a consequence to that. You'll see health and well-being and physical, but also mental consequences to that. The analogy I like to use here is about the elite athlete. So if you've got an elite athlete who is, say, training to run 1,500 meters, and they've got a coach that's working with them, the coach wouldn't get that athlete to run a full sprint, full pelt, all day, every day while they're training. They just wouldn't, because what would happen is, well, the athlete would not succeed. They would fail. They would break. The athlete might say, this coach is terrible, I'm off here. But what the coach would do instead is they'd have periods of intensity followed by a period of rest, followed by a period of learning and reflection and looking at what's happened with the previous training. That's how humans thrive and succeed whenever we have that approach. We've got periods of intensity, we've got periods of rest, and we've got periods of learning. We're not doing that just now. From what you described, I think your people you've worked with are just doing the sprinting all the time. They're just doing the high intensity stuff. They're not even taking a break properly. They're not getting fresh air. They're not giving their brain a chance to pause. And I'm pretty sure, again, just putting my lifestyle medicine hat on here, that they're probably not eating well, they're not physically active, and they're almost certainly not sleeping well, because if you expose yourself to that amount of screen time every day, your brain and your eyes are not going to be in a good way to unwind at the end of the day and get to sleep and stay asleep. They're probably also not going to be the best partner, husband, wife in the world, or parent as well, because they're, again, their focus has been, on the fast forward button, on the rush all the time, and not giving your body and your brain a chance to do the recovering bit and the learning bit as well. So yes, I think absolutely, if you drive the car fast the whole time and never slow to take on fuel and to get serviced, then it will break eventually. And yeah, I think as well, you've mentioned that people look back and say, oh, I did take that break and that I felt much better for it. You've maybe seen as well that people who have experienced ill health or have experienced burnout or been off for a period of time unwell and then they're back at work, they'll say things like, I realized that the warning signs were there. Mm-hmm. I realized that, you know, I was totally overdoing it and I wasn't giving myself a chance to rest. And I can see that now. And what a shame that is, that it took a period of ill health or a burnout episode for people to realize that the harm was there and that was happening.
This gets me thinking then, is there a second step after, you know, the cultural changes you've discussed? And maybe the layer below that, or, you know, looking at the culture a little bit more in depth, would you recommend that maybe our leaders in HR have a checklist? Maybe certain questions we're asking our team every week, every couple of weeks, just for everyone to get that space to do that self-check-in and get them to actually think about themselves for a change instead of what's going on with, you know, the pressures within the organization.
Absolutely. I think that what you described is, it isn't just a nice extra. It's not a little bonus. It's absolutely essential. Allowing people to have that space to check in. It has to be a safe space as well. It has to be a space where you can feel free to speak your mind without consequence and know that you'll be listened to. Again, that's really important. So I think just crucial to see that as an essential part of thriving, rather than, well, this is quite a quaint, nice thing to do. But also, I guess, that sets the tone, that sets the culture in that department or in that organization. And here's a department and here's an organization that is interested in the well-being of our staff. We value our staff, we value our employees, and we want to know what they're thinking, what they're saying, what they're experiencing, what the challenges are. And we want to make sure that their voice is heard. And we want to make sure that they feel that they have a career trajectory, that they've got an idea of where they're going to, where they're going with their career. And hopefully those same people will be saying in the future, this is a great place to work. I'd really recommend this as a place to work, as opposed to just turning up, just being present and just getting through the day. Because that's the kind of other side, I suppose, that the other side of the spectrum, where people don't feel that there's a culture of well-being and support and thriving, and maybe feel that they just want to survive their job rather than thrive in their career.
Does this lead back to then, again, for leaders in HR? You mentioned there the short-term effects and how that impacts long-term. One of the things I'm starting to see with some of the leaders I'm working with is that their vision is typically very short-term. Maybe, and it's not just about the strategy of the business or, you know, the service, what we offer and what we do, is to stop thinking so much short-term, but actually having that time to step back, keep thinking much longer term, but not just about the strategy of the business, not just about what needs to be done, but actually bring in the whole well-being for staff as part of that and change that thinking, which I think is generally becoming more short term than it ever has been.
Yeah, absolutely. And we talked at the start about the well-being initiatives. I mean, yeah. Actually, I think a lot of leaders and HR people might get confused with wellness and well-being. They're not the same thing. And those words tend to be used interchangeably. Wellness is about the absence of illness and about avoiding illness, whether that's a physical thing or a mental thing. And a lot of the stuff that you get shown as a well-being initiative is actually some kind of wellness little tick box type thing, like the mindfulness session, the bowl of fruit in the office, the yoga session or a therapist or something like that. Those are all very nice, pleasant things, but they're about wellness. They're not actually about well-being, which is about how content you are, how satisfied you are, and about how you feel things are going to be in your work now and into the future. That's well-being, and it's not the same thing. But I think too many leaders perhaps maybe get those two things mixed up, or maybe just use those words interchangeably. And I think that would be an important step forward to say those things are not the same. Wellbeing is about culture. It's not something you give to your employees, but you also model that culture too. I think, again, that's maybe something that's missed. Your juniors, your trainees absolutely look to you as a leader, whether that's in healthcare or in any other field of work. They look to you as an example of how you work, I suppose. If you're constantly busy, if you constantly skip your meals, skip breaks, do emails through your lunch break or send emails at 10 o'clock at night, that shows a negative culture for me. That's one where you don't look after yourself, you don't look after your own well-being, and that you value busyness, and that you value exhaustion, and that you value self-sacrifice over well-being and productivity. So again, you mentioned short term. I think the working through lunch and not taking a break and just being running around all the time, that's very much about short term for me. And you know, I know people say, well, I need to show how hard I work. I need to show, you know, what hard work is. And you know, actually that's spilling into overwork. It's spilling into a harmful working pattern. I work in a flow navigation center, which is about patients who can call in and get advice, and paramedics can call in and get advice and so forth, as well as working in accident emergency. One of the managers in that department at lunchtime goes around some of her staff and says, right, time to get your trainers on. And they all get their trainers on and they go for a walk around the hospital block for about 15, 20 minutes. And they do that every day, unless it's absolutely lashing, unless it's miserable outside. And they do that every day. And it's their manager, their leader, that gets them to do that. So they do that all the time. And then they have their lunch when they come back. They have something to eat, maybe together, maybe not. But what they're not doing is working through their lunch, sitting, doing emails, looking at their in-tray, because that's still work, actually. It's not actually a break. At 5 o'clock, that same manager also make sure everybody's switching their computer off and making sure they get out the door. Now, for me, that's a really positive culture, because in the half an hour run up to the lunch break, their productivity probably increases because they're thinking, right, I'm going to have to get my trainers on and go for a walk soon. I'll get this bit finished, as opposed to just getting to the finish line and then maybe you think, all right, I'll go and get something to eat and then I'll sit and do my emails while I'm eating my sandwich at my desk. And similarly, towards the end of the day, their productivity is probably high as well, because they're getting ready to finish and they know they'll be finishing on time. So that leader, that healthcare manager, is showing really good example, I would say. And it's in a positive way, and it's in a relatable way that people will respond to and thrive in.
Does that link? There's a quote which I love personally, and it says, "Nature does not hurry, yet everything is accomplished." Is that a takeaway really from what we're saying here today?
No, absolutely, absolutely. And again, thinking about that long-term maybe vision, if you want to put it that way, that building a culture where what you value is about clarity, about realistic objectives. It's about having decisions that are made in a calm manner. It's about people that actually want to be there and, you know, want to pull people in. You know, that for me is where I would like to get to. You know, that would be a really great objective to get to.
Final question, because we're going to move into a part two in the next episode. What's the one thing you wish every leader understood about well-being that almost none of them do?
That's a great question. I think every leader should ask themselves, is the way I'm working just now conducive to health, well-being, and thriving in my department? Or is the way I'm working harmful? I think if people took a moment just to think about the way they work and what its impact is on the people who look up to them, you know, so you don't just observe culture, you actually set the culture. You set the culture by what you do, and you reinforce it by what you praise. You know, if you praise people being exhausted and you value people being working them through when they're sick or, you know, don't feel like it, then, you know, that's what gets rewarded, and that's what continues that cycle. So yeah, I guess that's a very long-winded answer, but just to say, I think I just take a moment to think about the way I work just now. Is that leading to a healthy, productive, positive example for the people that I work with?
I love that. Calvin, great way to end. And we continue the conversation in the next episode. So for now, thank you very much indeed.
I'll very much look forward to that. Thanks again.
Thank you for listening to Beyond Leading. If this episode was useful, follow or subscribe so you don't miss the next one, and share it with someone who'd appreciate it. And if you've got a minute, a quick rating or review really helps more people find the show.